So that project and that context is triumphalism. And it's important to realize that that's the moment. We wonder, well, why did people support it? And the polls show a lot of people did. A lot of people supported Daniel Williams, and it looks like, according to the polls, and we know polls are notoriously inaccurate, but people support at least the original term sheet and the original Muskrat Falls project. And a lot of this, you need to understand that moment of high energy prices even after the global economic meltdown. Oil prices are not going to collapse for a few years yet. Daniel Williams is arguably in 2008, 2009, even coming up to 2010, still historically, in unprecedented terms, a remarkably popular premier. And it's building on a rebranding of the province. So it's masters of our own destiny, or masters of our own house. The speech of the front gave various versions of this. The idea of remaking the province, remaking the logo, remaking the name. They took the "and" out. Right, remaking as much of the terms of the image and the branding of the province as possible. So the idea that 2003 with the Williams era is day one, and that this was going to be, and again, I always remember the concluding page of Bill Rowe's Daniel Williams in the War with Ottawa. He said that if, and of course this was in the future, if Daniel Williams can sign an agreement to develop the Lower Churchill, he will go down as the greatest of our premiers. You can look it up, it's the last page of the book. That Bill Rowe was not saying anything new or different. Bill Rowe was reflecting the same things that he would have heard on Open Line. This is a kind of a conventional wisdom in Newfoundland, that you want to go down as the greatest hero, then you need to sign the Lower Churchill. Why? Because it's redress against the grievances of the Upper Churchill. So it's part of this process. It's linked with the war with Ottawa, it's linked with falling down the Maple Leaf, it's linked with all of the ABC, which we tend to forget about, right? The ways in which the culture was really in a period of turmoil and flux, with high energy prices and a very combative leadership that we haven't seen since. It's not just any time, I guess is my point. And if we lose sight of that, we'll lose sight of why Muskrat Falls was started in the first place. And one of this is a line from the Speech of the Throne, which always for whatever reason, it really stuck with me, is that for the Williams government, they were not going to be constrained by the past, right? There's the idea of breaking with the past. But the irony was, is that they're going to break with the past by continuing the path of resource development. So you have a problem with the Upper Churchill, with the original agreement. You solve the problems created by one dam by creating another dam. And so it's this interesting juxtaposition by saying it's going to be new, it's going to be different, and yet it's also at the same time building on a narrative which is so deeply embedded that people don't even realize it. You know, it's part of the unspoken assumptions of the culture. So when the day came, and as you know, to paraphrase Brian Peck, for some days the sun did shine. And so it was presented as a moment of triumph, routing the impasse of Quebec. And we all know it. I don't need to get into details about what critics of Muskrat Falls were called, betrayers, traitors, and lots of other things, straight through before, during, and after this period. And so the idea that it's not just anything, it's not just a dam, that's my point. It had to be seen as a path of triumph, of redemption, or as the Globe and Mail put it, revenge, as a way of redressing and dealing with history, and in some ways ending that phase of Newfoundland history. And that's how it got understood. I think my worry is that now when we talk about it, we take all that out, we drain all that out of it, we drain all the history and all the drama, and we see it through neoliberalism or capitalism or economics and all those things. But I think one of the biggest questions and queries I've always had is that the problem is when we take these mega projects on those terms, so you take it on the term that Nalcor offers, the presumption, and I think the problem is it always makes sense. Now you can debate it. You can say, well, okay, I don't accept this. And we had wonderfully eloquent talks today which gave out all the powerful reasons why you should question the rationales for these mega projects. But the problem is if you debate it only on economic grounds, then you're accepting the terms of that debate. And you're presuming that it has economic reasons. So if you have just enough economic or engineering points to rebut those arguments, well then you can, that's the way that the argument should flow. My point is that it's culture and politics. And this doesn't make Newfoundland and Labrador that exceptional. If you look around the world, dams are built for reasons which are very particular in terms of local politics and nationalism. And so for Williams, and this is straight from that magazine article, it's the day, hopefully, when Newfoundlanders can finally let go of the Upper Churchill and say, done, it's over. Now for us, when, as a historian, we're trained to pay attention to the evidence, Williams is telling the readers, and telling anyone who'll listen, And he even used the word psychological, that this is a process through which to deal with 1969. Right? It's not just about needs. It's not just about selling energy. Well, in some ways, it's not even. It's secondarily is about selling energy or meeting the province's needs. Those explanations, by the way, came later. The immediate explanations. This is 2011. You know, just literally a few months after he resigned and then as premier. It's about when we can let go. We can get closure. In a collective way. Right? And that's how he's understanding. And I think, you know, to be fair to Daniel Williams, he's just reflecting and saying things that tens of thousands of other people are saying and thinking. Right? So he's not inventing this. You know, I'm not going to have a conspiracy theory where it's just Daniel Williams. If Daniel Williams, he was popular for a reason. And I think one of the sobering facts that Newfoundlanders in particular need to realize that, you know, there's a reason why he was as popular as he was. There's a reason why people cheered when he pulled down the Maple Leaf in 2004, and it stayed down in early 2005. And I think those things, there needs to be an accounting to that. So there's a picture of Wade Locke, and again, Memorial University economist, one of the biggest, most prominent people discussing Muskrat Falls. He's taken different positions on Muskrat Falls over the years. But this is an economist using an argument about history. Now, Wade Locke is a lot of things, but he's not a historian. Making a discussion, and to me it really jumped out when I was looking at the PowerPoint slide, saying we should learn from our history but not be slaves to it. Because I heard, and someone who was trying to follow this, and this is in 2012, there was a lot of discussion about Muskrat Falls as emancipation. That the way to emancipate ourselves and to get over our past, as Daniel Williams just suggested, is through the dam. In other words, it's not just a dam, right? It's not just about energy. It's about redemption, it's about memory, and it's about closure. And in this instance, it's about slaves. To use that now, to me as a historian, I see people use that kind of language. It's hard to think of a more evocative and powerful and dangerous language to use is slaves. When people are telling you those things, they're telling you there's something important going on. And it's more than just sitting down with a calculator. And so for me, this moral equivalence, which I alluded to, and this is straight out of what Premier Dundadel says, straight direct quote, failure to take the right course of action today would be no different than taking the wrong course of action a generation ago. And to me, that really sums up in a lot of ways the political calculus, how we understand Muskrat Falls politically. Are you going to understand economically, socially, environmentally? Yes. But if we're going to understand, we also need to understand it politically. It's the idea that if you don't support it now, you are no better than the people who supported 69 or supported the failed policies of the 70s. That the only way to get over that is to go along with this and to support the Muskrat Falls and the Lower Churchill development. That's I would argue, a very powerful argument to make for people who have raised an entire generation, or really two generations, of this political culture. Because you're saying that if you don't do this, right, if you don't do this, then you're condemned to failure. Right? So it's raising the stakes at a level that's not talking about resources, it's not talking about the environment. And then finally, what was interesting, because I didn't hear this and see this before, we have the kind of the image of the Hoover Dam and the idea, which was interesting because when I was asked about this in 2012, I gave a talk at the Rooms about Muskrat Falls and someone asked me, why? Why build Muskrat Falls? And it's the one and only time I met Dwight Ball. And I talked to him afterwards about this and I said, well, it's not really just a question of why, it's why now. Because when you have an economy that's so overheated, and this is before 2015, when you have high commodity prices, when you have so many construction projects in the province, you know, the Hoover Dam is about stimulating an economy in the midst of a depression. And I just find it really interesting to see the analogy of the Hoover Dam as a way of creating jobs in a place which had already had so many short-term construction jobs. And the argument about a Hoover Dam was an argument that came late in the day. So the lesson for us and the lesson for me as a historian is that the narrative changes. The stories change. Right? It's fluid and it's unstable, which makes Muskrat Falls, I find it intellectually fascinating. But as a Canadian, as someone trying to understand, it's also troubling because it morphs and mutates. Just when you think you have it, I understand what Muskrat Falls is, then it becomes something else. And then it mutates on you. And then a year later, this is a quote from Russell Wangirsky writing in the Telegram, a year later, Russell Wangirsky is telling the readers, get out. The Newfoundland is just, it's gone, right? It's just one of these ways in which I think there has to be a reckoning, you know, that Sean and others talked about democracy and a democratic deficit. And David Verley gave a wonderfully eloquent discussion about that. But a part of that has to be the fact that Newfoundland culture is always in this, it's either on the cusp of triumph or disaster. Right? It's either one extreme or the other. And you go from within a few years of saying that we're the masters of the universe to saying, get out, it's done, it's over. It's this way that Newfoundland is always this story, this narrative of struggle, in a way which until you live somewhere else, and it took for me to move to another province, I realized that's a very particular way of looking at things. And then finally, I want to finish, well, I've got a few more minutes, and I want to get to some other concluding remarks, but this is where the story is today. And I had to check, and I was talking with people who were there, I was not there last week, is it goes from boondoggle now to the most over-governed project ever. So just when you think you've got a handle on it, it slips away again, right? Now it's the most over-governed project. But it was a boondoggle. But now it's the most over-governed project ever. And I think it's no accident that Stan Marshall is saying ever, because Muskrat Falls has to be the most everything. It's either the best project ever or the worst project ever. It's either a boondog, it's either terrible, or it's amazing. It's always got to be something superlative, rather than just being a project. And I think we need to recognize that that's the way it was born in that political moment during the high point. Newfoundland nationalism was never as high as it was during the last part of the Williams era, 2009, 2010. It's the high water mark. It's never come back to the level of fervor that we had in 2009, 2010. And now it's continuing to change and to morph and to mutate. My point is that those are stories that Marshall is telling. They're ways of understanding and branding it. So it's either a boondoggle, and you can understand in those terms, and now it's the most over-governed project ever. That has causality embedded within it, blame. And there's so many things that we need to understand in terms of the rhetoric. You know, just piercing and understanding the rhetoric of Muskrat Falls is enough to keep you busy for a whole year, let alone understanding all the complex issues that we got at earlier today in terms of the environmental issues and everything else. My point is, politically, if you're going to address this and resource development in the future, you need to understand where the politics is coming from, right? Because that's the cause, right? That's where these things are emanating from. If you don't engage with it on a political and rhetorical level, you're going to miss the point. Because the dam was never, Muskrat Falls was not sold, really, on economic rationales came out after the fact, right? It's sold as a project of political redemption, is I would argue, a political mythology. And so I would argue, I guess, in the end, that we're not as far away, and for those Newfoundlanders of my generation, we're not as far away from the Smallwood era as we would think. You know, the ghost of Joey Smallwood is still with us. It's still with us now. We talk about resources as being an unmitigated good, and then if they cause the problems that we have, well, then all we need is the solution to resource mismanagement is more resources, right? We're just one deal away from having the sun will shine again. And I think in some ways we're not as far away from this era as we would think we are. So the final few points, there's three conclusions, if you can bear with me. And thank you for your patience. And again, I know there's a lot of things that I haven't talked about, but I just want to give you an overview from a historian's perspective to complement the things that we talked about earlier today. And in no way does this in any sense diminish or replace, or it just complements the things that we talked about this afternoon. It's just another layer, right? But I would argue it's an important layer. Right? And if we have a discussion of Muskrat Falls that does not include history, that, I think, is a recipe for some problems. So I'm just arguing that it contributes to the discussion. So the first is presentism, and that's the term that I used before. Psychologists use it, social psychologists, anthropologists, and historians. And it's a way in which we presume that the past, we see the past through the eyes of the present, and I think particularly in the problems for Muskrat Falls going forward, is looking at the future and presuming that energy prices or demand or culture and politics are going to stay the same. And so it's this idea of I think Muskrat Falls in its origins needs to be understood in terms of presentism, but we in our debates need to be aware that no one knows where energy demand is going to be. No one knows where the price of oil is going to be. And I think a more honest discussion about the uncertainty of those factors, one just some amongst many, will go a long way in terms of recognizing that we're captive to where oil prices are today, to where demand is. The second is, I think, is nationalism. Nationalism has to be part of that. You look globally, when people discuss dams, they discuss nationalism. Nationalism is rooted in memory, which is rooted in a selective version or a selective process of how we understand a relationship with history. And I would argue that very much how we understand and should appreciate Muskrat Falls is through that process of myths. Myths are stories. And I'll never forget Ed Martin when he was asked in 2012 to discuss the project. And there was starting to be a kind of an opposition. It wasn't that strong yet. And he said, well, the stars are lining up. I'll never forget it. The stars are lining up. And I think he unwittingly kind of appealed to this way that Muskrat Falls was always on this level of epic, right? It always is this kind of this way in which it worked on a different kind of mythic level. The stars are lining up. It's this way of our fortunes are finally going to take a turn. And the fact that it's differentiated from the actual day-to-day level of governance. You know, if there's any recommendation I would have on how to handle resource development in Newfoundland and Labrador, is to take it down from the clouds and make it about just the quotidian day-to-day level about how you manage a society and govern a society. Stop talking about things in epic terms. The problems are not going to get solved. We can't solve the problems here over the next 48 hours. Dwight Ball can't solve them, despite whatever he announced on Monday, to lower expectations, not to raise expectations. And if you raise expectations too high, we're only going to take one set of problems and we're going to replace it with another set. So kind of draining the mythological elements of this from it. And then finally, and this is a term, it's nothing I invented, it's from behavioral economics, because what's interesting about Muskrat Falls, it's going on at the same time as we get the global financial crisis, the subprime bubble in the United States. And I think one of the things we don't realize, there's a really fascinating literature to discuss that. My favorite is John Cassidy, who wrote How Markets Fail, talked about how the commodities bubble and the high oil prices and people thinking, well, I think it was 144 peaked, but we were talking about peak oil for a long time. High energy prices, $100 a dollar a barrel forever, realizing that has a really particular and in some ways fundamental way of affecting the ways in which people talk about resource development in particular. And so Cassidy talks about what he calls rational irrationality, meaning that short-term political decisions can somehow have, sometimes and oftentimes, have very particular rationalities attached to them. But on a larger aggregate sense, societies, including the United States financial sector, did things that was fundamentally antithetical. Right? It was irrational. They nearly broke the global economy. And I think that relationship between rational economic decisions and announcements by Nalcor and the ways in which fundamentally, I would argue, it never really made sense. Right? It wasn't what it was meant to be. Right? So this juxtaposition, this mixture between the rational short-term ways in which it was discussed and the justifications and the larger irrationality. You know, that we have that discussion, we're linking up with the broader discussions that economists have had in other countries and getting away from this kind of Newfoundland exceptionalism where that somehow everyone here's fundamentally, you know, it's exclusive or somehow we're making worse decisions than anywhere else. I mean, these mistakes that were outlined so clearly, and a lot of the hopes and a lot of the correct decisions, a lot of good decisions and bad decisions, people across North America and globally have made these mistakes as well. And there's a lot of lessons, I think, to be learned by instead of burying ourselves in our provincial sand to start to look at how other people in other places have discussed these issues. Because dams in other places are not seen as of unmitigated goods. Resource development is not. It's seen as problematic, with full of trade-offs. And the kinds of trade-offs and difficult decisions that we heard about today. So I think that's where I'm going to end it, and thank you very much for your patience.